Yeah, I was a acolyte growing up at church, and I always super enjoyed it, the getting to carry fire on a stick up to the front of the church. I don't know why they let us do it, but it was super trustworthy. I think this might be a fireproof, a child's proof thing. Okay, we need one. You try it. That is that's a tricky one. All right. So good morning. We are on peace today, which was the second candle. Daryl addressed hope last week, and we're on peace today. And pretty much half the sermon was already preached on the songs today and then in the prayer. So I just want to read real quick here the lyrics that we were just singing. Because sometimes you can sing and not fully hear what you're saying. Christ by highest heavens adored, Christ the everlasting Lord, late in time behold him come, offspring of a virgin's womb, veiled in flesh the Godhead see, hail the incarnate deity, pleased with us in flesh to dwell, Jesus our Emmanuel. All right. So, Jesus, we just honor you today in who you are. God, we ask for peace in the room as we look upon you, as we gaze upon you, as to what Christmas is and to what you've done. We just ask that you would take the center place. And Holy Spirit, we ask for peace in the room with all the different holiday seasons and all the different preparation and stuff that goes on. God, we just ask that you'd make known to us Jesus and you give us inner peace. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so I was thinking about peace and how do you define peace? And it's very, very broad in my mind. And I was like, what to talk about? I can kind of talk about anything. I got like an open door here. And I was trying to dial it down, and I was like, how do I define peace? And I kind of like two working definitions in my mind and the way that we kind of use it. We use peace as kind of like inner peace, like I am at rest, or I have tranquility, or I'm still. Like I'm not, and it's contrast to I'm stressed out, I'm rushed, I'm worried, I'm anxious, I've had too much coffee, Christmas season's coming up, and I don't have my stuff ready to go. Like that type of peace is opposed to internal stress and turmoil. And then you can also use peace where, like, me and Pastor Tom, we're at peace, you know, or I'm at peace, as opposed to, like, relationally peace, that we are connected, we are at peace with one another. There's nothing between us that would interfere with the peace, or we're reconciled. And that would be in conflict to, or in we're at war or enmity, or conflict, and so those are the kind of two things, kind of the inner idea of peace, and then kind of the relational thing, and we're going to hit them both today, related to Christmas, related to what the whole season is about. So we'll start with inner peace, and then we'll end with relational peace, and relational peace also affects your inner peace. How does Christmas, the most peaceful season I've heard, I think the stats say, the most peaceful season, how does that relate to inner peace or peace of mind? And I know Pastor Tom hit it, I think, in passing a couple weeks ago. He mentioned a study from Berkeley that talked about awe, and I don't know exactly where he put it, but awe in the inner life and what it does when we focus on something and we're in awe or amazed or just gasping at, like, the magnitude of something, specifically the Lord, in this context. And I think if we're rightfully perceiving what's happened at Christmas, there should be a level of awe. So that awe, which I believe is available in the gospel, is available to us as you stare at Jesus and the inner peace is available. It's not a given. I think that effort is required just because you signed off that, yep, I believe Jesus was born of a virgin, check, check, got it. The inner peace is not a default. It's going to take an effort of gazing, of focusing in on Jesus and on the season and what's happened. The Lord has not promised to fix our circumstances or to make all of our ducks line up in a row or everything ideal. Mary didn't have that as she was treasuring these things in her heart with the conflict going on around her, with the Roman Empire, with the rumors of childs out of wedlock and what have you, but she was treasuring these things in her heart, and she was able to walk in peace beyond circumstances, and I think that's available for us. It requires a couple things the Bible keeps on telling us to remember, 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 and it just says that repeatedly. Set your mind on, think on the things that I've been spoken amongst you, meditate, worship, sing, and this is what we do in Christmas. This is where there's all these traditions around. There's normally little images of baby Jesus, you know, with the wise men, the shepherds, the angels. We always remember the story. So this season is strategically set up for us to remember. And so what are we going to set our minds upon to provide inner peace? We're going to set our minds on not abstract principles, not philosophy, but a person. Jesus. We're going to focus on who he is. And I think the stories, lots of babies have been born. There's lots of babies have been born back there, lots of babies born now. And it's the understanding of who he is that changes the import of the stories. So I could tell you, for example, that I was talking with Tom yesterday. And you might be thinking, well, that's okay, your son, Tom, Thomas. You could think Pastor Tom. You could think Tom Cruise. You could think Tom Brady, right? I mean, it totally changes the game. Who Jesus is impacts the story dramatically. Like, if we acknowledge who this is that is coming before us in this season, who came, it changes the dynamics completely, and it's the identity of him. So we're going to, if you will, open up the hood and look underneath what we all probably assume is happening in Christmas, but I just want to state it. It's normally assumed and kind of walked like, yeah, I know that, yeah. But we're going to open up the hood, look in the engine, and talk about the basics of what we're saying happened at Christmas. And we're going to use three probably big words. Some of them are in the songs already here, and Kelsey already prayed one of them. But we're going to hit it on three big words, and it just helps. I would just say deep thought does not undermine emotions or devotion or connection to the Lord. I would say they, if rightly understood, to think deeply about the Lord lets you give your heart more holy. If you think clearly about who God is, it lets you love him more holy. Now, it's not a given. You can think clearly about God and be completely somewhere else. But it does give you handles in terms of how to emotionally, devotionally, like, worship Jesus. Hail, incarnate divinity, as you stare over the baby. Hail, it is worthy to get down on your knees and give him everything. And so, like, having ideas helps the worship and devotion. So the three words we're going to hit today are pre-existence. Does everybody say it? Pre-existence, and we'll define them and work through them. Pre-existence. Perfect. Thank you. Incarnation. And the fun one, hypostatic union. Oh, Roberta's giving me a funny look. Okay, so we'll define them. I'm just saying, everybody probably already believes them, you just might not have the words associated with the centrality of what they are, and it changes the game. So, pre-existence. What that means is that Jesus existed before he was born or conceived. Jesus existed before he was born or conceived. 2,000 years ago was not the first time that Jesus experienced anything. He existed before he was born or conceived. And I would say that this is against some popular opinion, we do not exist before we were conceived or born. We were formed together in our mother womb. I've heard country songs that were like some child in heaven, like got brought down. And that is not, we have a beginning, and it happens when a mom and a dad come together and then there is a baby. That is not Jesus' beginning. Jesus' beginning is before that. So the evidence for that is in the Gospels, in the Jesus a lot of times says, I have come, or I have been sent. And he's generally not talking about Nazareth. He's not talking about Bethlehem. He's talking about a higher level. I have come, or I have been sent. Sometimes he especially says, from the Father. John says this quite a bit in John 8, 14 and 23. Jesus answered, even if I do bear witness about myself, my testimony is true, for I know where I came from and where I am going. And he's not talking about Bethlehem again. But you do not know where I came from or where I'm going. He said to him, you are from below, I am from above. You are of this world, I am not of this world. And I would say the whole book of John, you can sit there and divide it, and probably the whole first half in my mind is about where Jesus came from. And the whole second half is about where he's going back to. And you can do it other ways, but that's one of the ways that I kind of like divide the book of John. He's kind of like, this is where I came from, just so you know. So the other thing is he is called the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end, which means he didn't just exist before his conception. I mean, he was alive before 2,000 years ago, but it's not like he was just alive 3,000 years ago or 4,000 years ago. He was alive at the very beginning. He says, I am the beginning and the end. I am the A and the Z, the Alpha and the Omega. And so it wasn't just that he was formed a few hours before his conception up in heaven and then just kind of came out, but he is from the very beginning. The very beginning, all the way back, he was still there. What was he doing? We get a few different indications of what he was doing. In John 8, 56 through 58, in a big argument with the Pharisees and Sadducees, Jesus says, your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad. You are not 50 years old, they said to him, and you have seen Abraham? Very truly, I say to you, Jesus answered, before Abraham was born, I am. And so what he's saying is that he's giving an allusion to when Abraham sat down and had a meal with God in Genesis 18, he saw my day. I had lunch with Abraham. I am before Abraham, and Abraham experienced me. So that's one of the things he was doing. Jude 5, another thing he was doing. Now I want to remind you, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved a people out of the land of Egypt. So he was doing something, and Dave mentioned this a couple weeks back when he was talking about the Transfiguration. He was participating in the exodus from Egypt, coming to Mount Sinai and going to the Promised Land. I think he was in the pillar of fire and cloud. I think he was at the bottom. I think the Father was the top. Personal opinion. But he was participating, one way or another, he was participating in the Exodus. What else was he doing? This is the big one. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. Firstborn not meaning that he was the first thing made, but he has the firstborn rights, meaning the double inheritance of creation, in my opinion. For by him all things were created. So he was all things, everything is created. In heaven and earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. So, I mean, he was helping the Father together. They were making everything. So he's done a couple things before he shows up on the scene about 2,000 years ago. This is not his first rodeo. This isn't his first appearance even. It's his first unique appearance in a different way. So the Old Testament sets up a couple things with that gives a context for the pre-existence. It talks about the plurality of God. Elohim, God itself in the Old Testament, is primarily in a plural. Some people argue that this is the royal plural, like we, when the queen speaks or something like that. You could argue either way, but God is primarily in the plural, and it normally goes with a single verb, and there's a book called The Divine Community of Single Action, which is kind of the Godhead always working together in what they do. There's other places where it says, let us, where God says, let us make man after our image. And then God made man after not his image with the angels, but after his image. And that's how humanity is formed. There is a reference to the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament. And the angel of the Lord is worshipped and acknowledged as the Lord multiple times. And there's this, I've seen God, but I didn't die. And so there's an angel of the Lord that is also the Lord. And I don't think he's a created angel, but that's part of his role. So the angel just means messenger. So there's a messenger of I am who is also acknowledged as the I am. And so you have this. And in first century Judaism, there were ideas about a plurality within the singleness of God. This sets the context, the possibility for whatever's going on within the Godhead, somebody to come on down without evacuating the throne, if you will, that there's still somebody else sitting on the throne. But that Jewish thought of the Jewish thought of monotheism was redefined after conflicts with Christianity in such a way to make things divide 100 years or so afterwards. So the plurality of God is one thing that sets the context, the possibility of the incarnation. The other one is the form of God. And this one is a big one. God often shows up and walks amongst his people. He walks in the garden with Adam and Eve. It says he walks with Enoch, and then Enoch was no more. He walked with Noah. He shuts the door on the ark for Noah. He has lunch with Abraham. We already talked about it. He has a wrestling match with Jacob where they wrestle, and then God, like Charlie horses, punches him in the leg. I read it as a Charlie horse punch because he's limping after it. He didn't just touch him in the leg. And Moses sees God in the burning bush, which is the angel of the Lord in the burning bush, and he's afraid to look at God. Then Moses, later on, as Miriam and Aaron confront Moses, they about who he's married, and God confronts them and says that Moses beholds the form of the Lord. Joshua gets down on his knees and takes off his shoes with the Lord of hosts, with the commander of the Lord's armies. The commander of the Lord's armies, as you see the Lord's armies there sitting above that child. And he takes off his shoes and does the same thing that Moses does. Anyway, there's multiple ones. So that plurality in the form of God, there's plurality within the singleness of God, and there's the form of God. Both of those ideas kind of come together in the climactic prophetic chapter of Daniel 7. This is where the Son of Man rides the clouds up to the Ancient of Days and receives a kingdom and glory and dominion and power and receives that from the Father. And this is where the title the Son of Man comes from, which is Jesus' favorite title of himself. Who do you think the Son of Man is? And he doesn't say I. He consistently uses this cryptic phrase to refer to himself. Who do you think the Son of Man is? And in my mind, sometimes more directly than not, he's giving an allusion back to Daniel 7, where these ideas of the plurality of God, where there's, and this is where the Jews had said, there's an old Yahweh and there's a younger Yahweh, and they don't know and don't talk about it too much, or you're going to end up into heresy, and I don't know. But there was something, Jesus existed before he was born from the very beginning, and he didn't just exist, he existed at the very beginning, and he didn't just exist, it'll say he exists in the form of God, and he's interacting. So there is somebody that's up there, that's moving and doing things even down here that exists from the very beginning. So that's the first one, pre-existence. Before he was conceived, he had existence, which is necessary for the next part, which is incarnation. Incarnation. And this is really what Christmas is about. Incarnation, which means in flesh, carnal, in flesh. A person that existed beforehand comes into flesh. So this is where you get reincarnation, which is different than what happened to Jesus. But if you believe in reincarnation, the spirit leaves your body and then goes incarnate into a camel or something. You come into the flesh of some other thing, right? So this is what we said, behold, divine incarnation. There was a pre-existence in the form of God who came into a human being, right? This is not what happens to us. We are not having pre-existence then come into a body. We are made as one, as body and spirit together when we are knit together in our mother's womb. But Jesus had existence and then became incarnate. And this was a one-time event. It's unique for Jesus. It didn't just happen to him passively either. And I think Kelsey prayed about this. He made an active choice to humble himself in this way. It's not like he was just sitting up there and all of a sudden the Father's like, boom. It actually says, Philippians 2, 5 through 8, have this mind among yourself, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself. He emptied his own self. He set aside his glory. Emptied himself taking on the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So there's two humblings here. There's a humbling from in the form of God, and he steps into the form of man in the manger there. And he's, well, probably before that, in when John is rejoicing at what's going on in Mary's womb, and he steps down there, and then he is born. But he is stepping down once, and then he's going to step down to the lowest of men to be degraded on the cross. And so he is making that choice of humility while he's sitting up in the heavenly places in the form of God. So that is a voluntarily choice. And so this, just touching it, two early heresies called Docetism is one. So the incarnate, you have the divine and the human coming together. And we'll get to the devotional application in the end. Just brace with me here. So they're coming together and they're held together. And this, I just say this is extremely important for devotion too. And so they're held together, and there was different heresies in the church of how this works out. One of them was called Docetism. Docetism generally acknowledged, like, yeah, that's God, but he's not a man. Like, there's kind of a misty thing, and da-da-da-da, and it was kind of denied, and, like, not sure what to do with it. And so they basically said, yeah, he's fully God, but there wasn't a man walking around with us. He just appeared to be a man, and you're confused. He was not a man. And that was one way of handling the, what do you do with this? What do you do with God needing to be picked up and breastfed and diapers changed or cloths changed or fed? Or what do you do with having to God learn how to talk? Like, what do you do with that? And it's like, let's just sweep a lot of this stuff under the rug and let's just say he just appeared to be a man that, no. And then the other one is called adoptionism, and this is where Jesus' origins, his pre-existence is denied, and Jesus is assumed to be a man walking around who was really holy, really good, and he was adopted into the divine identity, but he did not have that from origin, from his beginning. From his origins, he was just a man, and he was adopted into divinity. And both of those are off base, have been condemned, and they are not true to what the text and the New Testament describes Jesus as incarnation, as those two things coming together. So incarnation, that is the word for Christmas. Hail the incarnate deity. The deity picked up a body or came into a body, fused with a body, and was united to a body. So this leads towards pre-existence, which is necessary for incarnation. You've got to have existence before you can come into a body. And then you're incarnate in the body, the Lord was. And then what is that state? What does it mean to have God in a body? And this is where the hypostatic union defines it. And this is the result of the incarnation. This is how you would define Jesus, hypostatic union. And I'll just define this as briefly as I can, and we'll hit a couple of the terms. Jesus is both fully human and fully divine. I just want to read and pray one thing before I hit this one. Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see if they are from God. For many false prophets have gone out into the world. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God. So Holy Spirit, we just ask that you bear witness that you came in the flesh just right now, as I'm going to try to define it as best I can. In Jesus' name. Okay, so Jesus is both fully human and fully divine. There is no mixture or dilution of either nature. So this is where it's like his divinity kind of swallowed up his humanity and he's less human, or his humanity kind of diminished his divinity and he's not. So he is fully both. Without mixture, there is no mixture or dilution in either nature. And that he is one united person forever. I'll read it one more time. This is, Jesus is both fully human and fully divine. There is no mixture or dilution in either nature, and he is one united person forever. So the immediate conclusions, Jesus is the most supreme, sustained, veiled theophany, or the appearance of God. So this is kind of like all those appearances of God that we just kind of just run through real quick. And I know Dave was talking about this when Dave hit the Sinai thing, the phrase that, not the Sinai, sorry, the transfiguration a few weeks back. He was talking about Jesus and the comparison of the transfiguration Mount Sinai, of how there's so many parallels. The voice of the Lord, the cloud comes. They want to build tabernacles. They built tabernacles on Mount Sinai. Obey him. like the glory, he's shining, he's glowing, like Moses' face is glowing. You have Elijah and Moses, the two guys that walked into the cloud and talked to God on Mount Sinai. Both of these are the guys with experiences, and you just have this parallel, and the phrase that came to me is, the God who came in Sinai, the God who came in fire, came out of the fire that he might be with us when he returns in fire. So he's going to come back in that same fire that he had, but the God who came in fire at Mount Sinai came out of the fire in the most extreme sense and laid his glory down, and for reconciliation, to be our friends, to make things right, so that when he comes back in fire at the second coming, we might be with him. We might recognize him, we might be friends with him, and we might know the one who dwells in fire. That is because of the fully divine, fully human. So that has a number of different implications, that we worship a man. Like, it is right to imagine yourself as the wise men or the shepherds here, the wise men a year later, whatever you want to work your timeline, to worship the baby, to give him honor, to worship him, hail divine incarnation. Like, that's God right there. Like, he was, you could have picked him up. Like, I just say, you could have picked God up in your hands. So it's right to worship him. So one thing is that the entirety of life of Jesus screams divine revelation. Watch everything he does. Catch every move. It's filled with importance because of who he is. Like, it's one thing, like I said, we were talking earlier, if Tom, my son, does something, but if Pastor Tom comes over and does it, like, well, that's pretty cool, you know? But then you kind of like, then you have like, oh, Tom Brady came over, who's like, you know, like, why did he show up at my house? You start, who he is gives all the significance to everything he does. And it matters, it changes how you read the Gospels. Why is he up in Nazareth with 400 people in a small town, podunk town, doing nothing for 30 years? It changes everything. Anyway, so it's right to worship him. It breathes significance upon every way you read the Gospels. Every insignificant mundane detail is infused with importance because of who he is. And then the other thing is, there is a human on the throne of God. Up in the top of the heavens, there is a man sitting on the divine throne. To the right side of the Father, there is a man. He's our mediator. His mediation is not just that he hears our prayers and relates to the Father. It's in part who he is. He has every right to sit on that throne as God himself, to the right hand of his Father, but he is totally related to everything we go through. He's able to sympathize. And so who he is in these two natures to come in together makes him the supreme mediator just because of who he is. But he does it too, but it's also just who he is. So there is a man on the throne of God, which gives us hope. That's how the Father feels about humanity. I would want to say also the hypostatic union, or the two natures coming together and joined, I would say it's unending, and it said in the beginning. Some people think that humanity ended at his resurrection or his ascension, and somehow he does not have a body anymore. That is not true. He died, rose, ascended, and will return with the same body. He still has a body. There's a man. He's got hands, he's got hair, he's got legs, and he's sitting down at that supreme throne, right to the right hand of the Father. Okay, so the so what? So the worship team wants to come back up here. So what does this mean? So that was all the technical. We pulled up the hood, kind of looked in there. We talked about the pre-existence, that he existed before he was born. He existed from eternity past to eternity forward. So he has pre-existence, he is incarnate, he came in and joined himself with humanity. That is defined by the hypostatic union being fully man and fully God, not diminished. It's not like he's half God and half man. It's not like his Godhead diminished his humanity. He was still a crying baby. That Silent Night song kind of always, like, I'm not sure the night was silent. Some babies are, some babies aren't, and it's not sinful, it's just a baby. And so here's the so what. What does it mean? And I would say that if Jesus is who we say he is, and just in the song we just sung, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, if he is who we say he is, everything about it speaks of what God's heart is. I'll just say, God has every reason to be at war with us. Me personally, God has every reason to be at enmity with us, with sin, with shortfallings, with the ways that we've disregarded him, the ways that we relate to other people that are made in his image. God has every reason to be angry with us. He has every reason to leave us, just to be like, I'm not dealing with you guys anymore, to abandon us. I'm going to go start over. I am fed up. You're hopeless. Like, he has every reason just to throw in the towel and to, like, I'm just going to reset. We're going to move on. I don't know what happened there. That was a mistake. However, what he's done, and this is great to think about the baby right there on that Good News banner, who I love just that's the heavenly host. There's an angel army right there. That is their commander peeing on himself right below them. That is the commander of the Lord of armies, the Lord of hosts, the Lord of the armies. And he has every reason to be at war with us, to be in enmity with us, to be upset, but he laid down his weapons, he stepped away from his army, and he came to us in extreme vulnerability. Everything about him is God's heart. He's moving towards his people. He's wanting to get in there. He's stepping out of his fire, of the man that is on the Mount Sinai in fire. He's stepping out and unveiling his glory, his power, and he's stepping out. And it's like the enemy army commander just laid down all of his weapons and just came forward. And like, but even that, he's like, he didn't just come. He came as a little baby. I said, you could have picked him up. And his army is sitting right there above him, still with worship songs, still acknowledging that's our commander. And then they leave. And he lives a life outside of his entourage, outside of his armies, outside of 10,000s times 10,000s ministering to him, and rightfully so, to the point where he comes to the cross, do you want us to fight? And he's like, no, let it go. Do I not have 12,000 legions, or sorry, do I not have 12 legions of angels that I could summon right now? He still has the command over them. They're still his. This is the one that we talked about. Like, remember, if you remember the centurion who's like, don't come to my house. It's not worth your time. Just speak the word. I know who you are, and you will send, and one of your servants will come and heal it. And no apostle goes, nobody goes. And he says, how'd you know that? I mean, more or less. He's like, I'm blown away at your faith. And so this is the Lord of the armies coming before us in extreme vulnerability. And the Lord has taken the first step to come amongst us. The entire downward movement of the Lord, not just the final step to the cross, but the entire downward movement reveals the intentions of God's heart's desire. He's after something. He's not just like doing stuff randomly that cost him to the nth degree. He's after something. The Lord is after, he wants something. God has desires. He's not above emotions. He has holy emotions, but he is not above emotions. And he has jealousy. And he has hunger, and he wants something. And he wants something from every one of us. And he wants something. And he's after something in the way that he's done this. And the word in the Bible that it repeats is he's jealous. He wants our affections and our devotion and our worship. He's after something in the way that he's done this. And that's why he's come down to us. And that's why he's moved forward to us like this. So this season, with all the stories, and there's no other season where we think about the stories of Jesus the same way we do in Christmas, just think about what the Father is after, what he wants. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this, and there is zeal in how vulnerable he's come and how close he's come to us and the way he's approached us because of who that baby is.